Up to this point, we have been very impressed with the kingdom of Solomon. He was the wisest and wealthiest and most powerful king that ever reigned over the nation of Israel. In fact, this is how his kingdom at its zenith is described in 1 Kings chapter 10, starting at verse 23. Thus King Solomon excelled all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom. The whole earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put into his mind. Every one of them brought his present, articles of silver and gold, garments, myrrh, spices, horses, and mules, so much year by year. And the Queen of Sheba was amongst those rulers that had heard about Solomon and his wisdom and the amazing nature of his kingdom, and had traveled well over 1,300 miles from her kingdom, apparently, to come and meet with Solomon and ask him all sorts of questions. And she has to confess, it all took her breath away. And she was amazed by everything she'd seen and heard and experienced, that it wasn't even half of what had been rumored to her. Solomon is at his climax here, and he has produced the book of Proverbs. He has lived with peace and prosperity, not only to the borders of the promised land, as delineated to Abraham, but he is in control through treaties and tribute pacts of all the territory from the bend in the river Euphrates, there in modern-day Syria, all the way down to the very borders of Egypt on the southeast corner of the Mediterranean, and then all the way across to the empty portion of the Arabian Peninsula. So he has a significantly large kingdom for this time period, right there at the center of the ancient world. He's basically bridging the Asian continent, the African continent, and to some extent, because of trade that would have gone through the northern part of Mesopotamia, he's even probably got connections into Europe itself. So just an amazing time period. However, it falls apart so quickly once Solomon starts abandoning the precepts of the wisdom that he received as a gift from God. And part of that is because of the wealth and prosperity. We know that this is a big danger. When a person, as an individual, or a nation, as a group of individuals, becomes exceptionally wealthy, they become fat and sassy, as we would say. They become self-satisfied, and they quit looking toward God for guidance and start thinking of themselves as the one that gives them everything that they need. And so here we have in 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 26, a report that we've talked about before, and that is that Solomon gathered together chariots and horsemen. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen, whom he stationed in the chariot cities and with the king in Jerusalem. Now the Israeli kings, even before there were kings, were warned, do not multiply to yourselves wives, horses, or chariots. The reason for not multiplying the wives is because that's putting too much trust in political power, because that's what marriage is typified in the royalty. The reason they weren't supposed to multiply the horses and the chariots is because that represents military might, because that's high-tech military, to have this rapid weapons platform that is the horse and chariot. Solomon was not paying attention to God's warning in that area. So he's starting to make that a centerpiece of his kingdom. Even though he's living in a time of peace and prosperity where the chariots and the horses are not needed, they are still there and being leaned upon. Verse 27, let's talk about the wealth. The king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stone. They had so much silver that it was just like rocks laying around. That's how unvaluable it was in that time period. He made cedar as plentiful as the sycamore in the Shephelah. So the sycamore is a native tree to Israel. And so it was a common wood used in construction. But now, because of Solomon's importation of so much cedar, cedar is just as readily available as sycamore, which makes it likely that everybody in Israel was feeling rather prosperous and probably using both silver and cedar in their own home decorations and their home building projects. And so all of United Israel is getting fat and sassy, getting full of itself. And that's also going to be a problem. Verse 28, Solomon's import of horses was from Egypt and Kue. The king's traders received them from Kue at a price. So apparently Kue is down near Egypt. A chariot could be imported from Egypt for 600 shekels of silver and a horse for 150. And so through the king's traders, they were exported to all the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Syria. And this is where we find out that not only is Solomon building up his own chariot force, his own horse force, for his own purposes, he's also gotten into weapons training, trading. So he is buying these things to pass them on northward to other kingdoms that are wanting to have this sort of military power to use. And so this is the arming of the northern Middle East that will probably come back and bite Solomon's later kingdom, as in the kingdom of his descendants. Chapter number 11. Before we go there, let's talk about some of the timing here, my estimation. We know that Solomon became king while David was still alive. David put him on the throne as a kid. The tradition is, and I think it makes good sense, that he was about 15 whenever that happened. He will reign for 40 years from that time, which, if I'm correct, means he will die in his middle 50s, which is young. And Solomon started building on the temple right after his father died in the about the third year of their reigning together. David dies, and then Solomon becomes solo king and begins his temple building project in the fourth year of his reign. Takes him about 7 years to get that done, and then another 13 years to build his palace complex, which means that we're already in the 24th year of 40 years by the time Solomon finishes the major building projects, the major expansion of the city of Jerusalem. He actually makes Jerusalem at least twice the size that it was under David. And he even brings the older portions of Jerusalem up to the same level of quality that the new city of Jerusalem was. And it's not just that. He spends several years as well building on other cities all over his kingdom. and putting in chariot cities and horse cities, and rebuilding some of the ancient cities back up to the standard that he wanted to have. And so we're probably talking about when the Queen of Sheba showed up, that Solomon was already in the latter 20s of his kingdom and approaching the final decade of his service as the king. All this time, he was marrying new wives. Wives would be the full rights and privilege marriages. These would be to princesses. And then he married a whole bunch of concubines as well. And these would be lesser contractual arrangements, maybe business deals, temporary import or export arrangements. And so he's sealing deals with these secondary marriages. And all of that is in direct violation of what God had said that kings should be doing. And this starts dragging Solomon away from God into political and military power thoughts. And by the time we reach that last decade, and I think maybe even the last 5 years of that decade, so we're probably talking about after year 35, that's when this next thing starts picking up steam. 1 Kings chapter number 11. Now, King Solomon loved many foreign women, meaning non-Israeli, along with the daughter of Pharaoh. We've talked about her many times. That alliance marriage seems to have taken place under David's direction, when Solomon was still a teenager. But here's other kingdoms around Solomon's kingdom that he marries princesses from. Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite. So those are all on the eastern and southeastern side of his kingdom. Sidonian, that would be the northwestern corner of his kingdom, and that would be the Phoenicians. He's had very close ties with Hiram, the king of Tyre. And Hittite women. The Hittites actually had a range of kingdoms up to the north of the Syrian kingdoms. We're talking about up in northern Mesopotamia. So he married all of these foreign women, verse 2, from the nations concerning which he who is had said to the people of Israel, you shall not enter into marriage with them, nor shall they, neither shall they with you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. And that's the problem there. This is not a matter of genetic issues. There is absolutely nothing wrong with the intermarriage of all the different ethnic groups of planet Earth, because we're all one human race. There's only one race. That's the race of Adam and Eve through Noah and Mrs. Noah. We're all related. We're all human beings. But we have a whole bunch of ethnic groups that came into existence from the time of the Tower of Babel onward. And unfortunately, many of those ethnic groups became compromised by demonic activity to start worshiping pagan deities, that is, deities other than the true and living God. And so God's rule was, don't marry anyone who worships another god or goddess. And that was typically related to some sort of ethnic group. So Solomon totally blows that off. And we have to give blame where blame is due. David contributed to that before he passed away because he allowed it. So now, it says here that Solomon clung to these in love. And that makes good sense. I mean, if you marry someone, you're going to have a growing relationship with them. And Solomon does. Verse 3, here comes the big number. This is the climactic number. We saw a smaller number in the opera Song of Songs. He had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines. So the wives would be the women with full rights to have a child with him that would then be somehow in the line of succession to the throne. 300 concubines, these are ones that seem to have some rights and privileges, but probably not a right to have a child, certainly not a right to a child that's going to be in succession. Here's the problem. End of verse number 3. His wives turned away his heart. When we first meet Solomon, he is a man, even though this phrase is not used, it's still true. He was a man after God's own heart. David raised him to be that way. And when David died and God speaks to Solomon and says, "Tell me what it is that you want me to give to you," Solomon's response is, "I'm a kid. I'm inexperienced. I've got this huge country of people that belong to you that I have to reign over. Please give me your wisdom so that I can lead them well." So he was a man after God's own heart. He's the one that wrote the book of Proverbs where it says that the fear of the Lord, a healthy respect for he who is the beginning of knowledge. It's the beginning of wisdom. So he wrote all that early in his life and believed it. But over the years, he has begun to absorb all of the mindsets of these foreign women. And it's tearing him away from his relationship with God. Which is why, folks, our people, our young people, should never date, let alone marry someone outside of the faith of Jesus Christ. Our Bible-believing children need to marry the Bible-believing children of other people. That's just the way it should be. We should not be unequally yoked one to another because it's going to take the heart away, just like it did with Solomon. Verse number 4. For when Solomon was old, now I think that might actually reference him turning 50. Because the Israeli people kind of had this idea of you entered into your full adulthood by the time you got to your 30th birthday, and you were kind of moving into that leadership position, being an elder of the community by the time you hit your 50th birthday. And so Solomon would have hit his 50th birthday right around his 35th year on the throne. So somewhere in that last five-year area is what I think we're talking about here. When Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods. And his heart was not wholly true to he who is his God, as was the heart of David, his father. So Solomon begins to worship with his wives. And not just exclusively worshiping at the temple that he built. Verse 5, for Solomon went after Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Sidonians. Ashtaroth was the queen of heaven. She was the grain goddess. She was the fertility goddess. She was the sister, companion, wife, mistress of Baal, the thunder and lightning god of the Middle East. But not just after her, also Milcom, which is a slight variation on Moloch, which is a slight variation on the Middle Eastern word for king, Moloch. He also went after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. Now, this is the Ammonites were descendants of Lot, just like the Moabites were descendants of Lot. And they had adopted this religion that centered around a destroyer king god because of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah that is part of the birth narrative for their ethnic group. And so the way they worshipped this god, this twisted version of the god that destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, is that they would intentionally get drunk, have sexual relationships, and then the babies born from the last time this ceremony was gone through would then be burned up as an appeasement sacrifice to this god of fire and destruction. And it's all related to the story in the book of Genesis of the beginning of the Ammonite and Moabite race. And so Solomon is even getting sucked into that abominable relationship or religion. And I believe it's probably indicating that he had sex purposefully to produce a sacrificial baby. That's how bad it gets here at the end of Solomon's reign. Verse 6, here's the way it's described by the Holy Spirit. So Solomon did what was evil in the sight of He Who Is, and did not wholly follow He Who Is as David his father had done. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and for Molech, the abomination of the Ammonites, on the mount east of Jerusalem. So he actually builds a place for this drunken ceremony to take place where the burning up of the babies happens. And where does he build it? On the southern slopes of the Mount of Olives. Where the Mount of Olives is at now is across from the Temple Mount. That's where we usually think of the Mount of Olives. If you go south along that mountain, you're still on technically the ridge that is the Mount of Olives, but you get down to a place where these worship sites were built, which becomes a mount of abomination and blasphemy, because little babies are dying there on a regular basis within sight of the holy city of God, within sight of the Temple Mount. And verse number 8, and so he did for all his foreign wives who made offerings and sacrifice to their gods. So Solomon is famous to us as Christians for the building of the Jewish temple. But he also is infamous for the building of a whole bunch of worship sites to other pagan deities over on the Mount of Olives, over on the eastern side of the holy city. And that is why verse number 9 says, He Who Is was angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from He Who Is, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. That would be the first time when he offered him wisdom, and then the second time after the dedication of the temple. And verse 10, and had commanded him concerning this thing that he should not go after other gods, but he did not keep what He Who Is commanded. So God had warned him on both those occasions that I will bless you if you will remain faithful. Now remember, this doesn't catch God off guard. God knew all along that Solomon would make these free will choices, and yet God still kept working with him during the good years because those things needed done. But now God is going to have to use Solomon as an example of what happens when even good people rebel against God. Useful people rebel against God. Verse number 11. Therefore, he who is said to Solomon, since this has been your practice, and you have not kept my covenant and my statutes that I commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom from you, and I will give it to your servant. Now, that's a literally fulfilled passage. He's going to give it to somebody that worked for him. The northern part of the kingdom of Solomon is going to be handed off to an employee of Solomon. Verse 12, yet, for the sake of David your father, I will not do it in your days, but I will tear it out of your hand of your son. However, I will not tear away all the kingdom, but I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of David my servant and for the sake of Jerusalem that I have chosen. So God makes it plain here. The kingdom is going to split once you're dead, Solomon, because of your choices. However, because of my faithfulness, my intention to keep working to bring my glory to pass, I'm going to keep part of the kingdom intact around the temple building, around the temple site. Verse number 14. He who is raised up an adversary against Solomon, Hadad the Edomite. He was of the royal house of Edom. So this is one of the adversaries he gets down in the southeast corner of the kingdom. One of his tributary kingdoms rebels. Verse number 15. For when David was in Edom and Joab, the commander of the army, went to bury the slain, he struck down every male in Edom. For Joab and all Israel remained there 6 months until he had cut off every male in Edom. But Hadad fled to Egypt together with certain Edomites of his father's servants, Hadad still being a little child. So one of several adversaries that raise up against King Solomon.